to try and kill the tie off. The vital away goal in the first leg and the Libertadores group stage sealing goal in the second.
Back in and kept alive as well and rifled into the back of the net. Oh, that is just exquisite. Fidel Martinez, you are sensational.
Right, well, hello and welcome back to Wolford and Windsor's Libertadores podcast. One of the very few podcasts covering South American club football in English. And the biggest competition of them all, the Copa Libertadores. Ollie, I'm sat with you on a, you know, we like to keep things humble on the Wolford and Windsor's Libertadores podcast. So, yeah, we're in a nice, humble settings in the centre of the city. Really authentic, authentic background. And we had a brief hiatus, but we are back, Mr. Wolston. I think it's a two years since our last pod.
It's been a while. It's definitely been a while. We came back last year for the competition, but you did the first 3 weeks. I did the last 3 weeks, and we kind of like intercrossed on some of it. It was, it's good to be back. Lovely, lovely pad you've got for yourself here. We're in the back garden of David Windsor's place in Buenos Aires.
Yeah, well, let's not give exact locations away, Ollie, otherwise the stalkers will be here. But yeah, it's very good to be back, and it was great covering the first week, Ollie. And there were one or two big talking points.
I think there's some overall kind of talking points to look at in terms of the competition as a whole. And then, well, you had a few feature moments, should we say, for the week. One in particular, which some people will probably, I don't know, some people might enjoy it as like the raw nature that is football still on this continent, and the passion, should we say, of the fans going over the top. Obviously in Monday sports, no one wants to see the incident that took place, but we'll come on to it later on, I guess.
Well maybe we should kick off. It's the group stages of the Libertadores are up and underway, of course, the premier competition in South American club football. And look, you talked about modern football, Ollie. Now the game has changed a lot the last few years, right? In the last decade. I mean, it's changed so much. But I tell you what hasn't changed, and that is, as a spectator, I understand the modernization of the game can be frustrating, but one thing that's always been true, you can't throw rocks at opposition players. You just can't. That's never been okay, and it's still not okay. So this is a shout out to the mad Rosario Central fan that threw a rock at Maxi Oliveira after the game between Rosario Central and Peñarol. And it basically nearly took the lad's eye out. Like, it's a huge gash. We'll, you know, have a look at this on Twitter. It's absolutely mad. There's a huge gash down his face. There's blood everywhere. Oliveira's going mental. He wants to get in the Rosario Central fans. And, you know, he's fuming. For me, that was one of the big takeaways from the week. Obviously, it's completely unacceptable. And it was kind of a mad moment, Ollie. And like I say, yeah, a lot's changed. But that it's a no-no, isn't it? Fans throwing rocks at opposition players. I think we can all agree
no-no. It's pretty obvious that's something that we don't want to see in any sport, let alone football. Or pretty much at any point in your day-to-day life, having rocks thrown at you.
When you're at
that's
work,
a no-no.
You don't need a rock to be thrown at you.
Yeah, not by somebody who's annoyed with your performance at work.
That's the noise you might have heard there is just a little veranda.
Veranda cover coming out
I learned a new word in English today. What's it called?
The awning.
Awning, yeah. Barely heard that.
It's a Spanish word, I believe, actually. but you don't want rocks thrown at you at any point in your life, let alone when you're on a football field. It epitomises, as I say, what is still great and negative about the fans in the footballing culture in South America. That wild passion that can go over the top. It actually kind of interests me a little that of all the things to happen this week in the Libertadores, that might be one of the most exciting things to have happened, albeit a negative excitement, because there hasn't been too many other stories that I've noticed really that have been worth kind of touching on too much in this first round of group games. And it's a shame that that's the kind of feature that we've come away with this week, if that was the most important moment. Because there should be repercussions, right? We should be seeing investigation into the crowd. We should be seeing, I think, a bit more sympathy for the player who was, let's face it, was keen to get in with the supporters and find quick retribution after being hit by a rock, and rightfully so. Anybody would have that. And surely you'd have thought some sort of stipulation sanction has to be put down on Rosario Central as a club. And yet I've seen no fallout, no repercussions for that action yet. Whereas if you had that in European football, look, imagine a Liverpool player's away playing in Turkey in the Champions League next year at Galatasaray, say, and they get struck by a coin. Particularly a gash right next to the eye, pretty deep, a lot of blood that we saw in midweek this week. There would be behind closed doors games for Galatasaray in that group stage, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point and fair summary on it. I think one thing is that, no, you might not see that in European football, but you also wouldn't see the passion of those Rosario Central fans. So, I mean, the atmosphere an hour before kickoff was absolutely unbelievable. Rosario Central back in the Libertadores, of course, playing against Peñarol, you know, a club that has won it five times. They've been in 10 finals, albeit most of this was way back when, in kind of the 70s and 80s, during Uruguayan domination. So, yeah, I'm sure there will be repercussions for Rosario Central, and rightly so. I mean, another centimetre, another inch to the side, and the fella's blind. So, yeah, there will be repercussions for that. What else did we think about? I mean, is it fair to say, though, Ollie, that in any competition where there's group stages, it always takes a little bit of time to get going? I mean, you hear this as a criticism of the Champions League as well in Europe, that it is only until the knockout phase. It's not even arguing. It's only now at the quarterfinals when you look at it and you think, oh, wow, Real Madrid, you know, Man City and Arsenal, Bayern and these kind of games. It's only later in the tournament that it gets going. And, you know, match day one of six in the Libertadores in the group stages, of course it's going to take a little while to get going. And the Brazilian clubs as well, let's not forget, who are the big boys on the continent, a lot of them were resting and rotating because they're wrapping up their state championship games this weekend.
Yeah, that's 100% true. The Brazilian football thing, first and foremost, is interesting in that they do, when they get to the finals and semi-final stage of those state championships in particular, it becomes very serious for the big teams. I don't actually think it's too serious for them at the start of the competition, just because the level of opposition that they're playing against is so much lower for the large part than what they necessarily face in the Serie A in Brazil, the league campaign that obviously allocates the Libertadores spots and whatnot for the next year. So it suddenly becomes a very important issue very quickly when you, say, have Grêmio and Internacional battling it out for their regional tournament final because of the rivalries that you get in Brazil. So that's why they are putting out maybe reserve string players, young lads in the Libertadores this week. I think on a European level, the group stage is boring to some extent, and the knockout stages are more boring these days because of the gulf that we've seen in the switch in finances in world football. You go back 20 years ago, you know, Manchester United on the road against like IFK Gothenburg when I was young, and they were knocked out. And it wasn't considered an absolute travesty that United went out because there was a more of a level playing field.
Porto won it 20 years ago, right?
It was more entertaining at that point because there was a more level playing field across European football. You know, a tough game at Partizan Belgrade wasn't because you were dealing with fans. You were also dealing with a competent football team that had salaries equal to what you were playing your players in England. That's just not the case anymore. The best talent goes to the big leagues, goes to the big clubs, and that's why it's almost boring the group stages now. With the Libertadores, the shift with Brazilian sides compared to a lot of other teams, yes, creates that. I'm not sure, however, that the other sides on this continent are so far away and apart as a disparity. The Colombians, particularly the Ecuadorians, the Argentinians, you would have them on a similar wavelength of financial resources. I may be completely off on that. I'm just judging by what I've seen and we've seen around this continent. So it surprised me a bit more that the Libertadores group stage match day one has been as lackluster to some extent as it has been, because aside from the Brazilian sides, there is a more competitive playing field and you would expect there to be a few more shake-ups in the group stage in terms of second and third spot, which are mightily important in the Libertadores than, say, in European football.
Do you think as well, Ollie, it goes to show the dominance of Brazilian sides, that they, a lot of them, sort of think, well, you know what, match day one of the Libertadores, if we lose on the road or if we only, you know, draw at home, it's not the end of the world. We're so much better than everyone else in the group. We can just cruise through. And as you say, just to clarify, the state championship is like the regional championship, so it's not like the top tier Brazilian football, which gets underway next weekend. I think it's the 11th, 12th of April. That's when clubs from all around the country play, obviously, in their top tier. So state championship is something different. But do you think it's just a marker of how dominant Brazilian clubs are that they think, yeah, you know what, match day one, fine, we'll lose away in Venezuela, no biggie, you know, we'll...
Yeah, definitely, particularly if you're a Brazilian side and you're playing away on match day one, because it's about picking up a point away from home and winning your games on home soil in the Libertadores. You know, travel is so difficult. We've touched on this a million times on the podcast, altitude, etc. We can get into all of that at some point, I'm sure, in this competition, as every single journalist on this continent tends to do. But if you pick up a victory on home soil on match day one with a reserve team, or you can go away and pick up a point on the road, as you say, in like Caracas or somewhere like that, that's fine, because they know they've got the financial resources, the depth of their squads as well. Huge numbers in Brazil. Obviously, they have to register players for this competition, but they register 25 players that can all fill in almost like for a like a lot of these Brazilian sides. So they don't lose too much by rotating as much as we've seen this week. So they should still be finding victories anyway. And it's that Brazilian dominance that we've touched on that has only continued to grow since we've been away as a podcast, but hasn't changed in terms of South American football. Everybody is behind them right now because they have gone and shifted away from that traditional fan ownership and have taken instead outside financials from big businesses, corporate sponsors and billionaires. And that's why they can attract former European footballing stars, perhaps the second best of the crop of youngsters that haven't made it to Europe yet by the age of 16, 17. And it's what we see now, which is the continued dominance of the Libertadores and, to a lesser extent, the Conmebol Sudamericana.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Brazilian clubs have won the last 5 years, Ollie, right? Started 2019 when Flamengo beat River in that final with a couple of late goals. And it's gone on the 5 years since then.
It's a big shift, that. You think back at that final once more. You know, if River win it, the Gachado era obviously continues in phenomenal fashion. Two Libertadores titles to their name in 3 years or 4 years. And you still look at Argentinian footballers like, well, the Brazilians have got the money, but look what a manager can do when he's given some extra resources and he's allowed to bring a squad together with a style that they all understand. And actually, with Flamengo winning it, albeit narrow margins and late goals from Gabigol, that has started the trend of, well, three of the four semi-finalists are probably going to be Brazilian sides. And if they face anybody that isn't Brazilian in the final, it's going to be fairly one-way traffic.
That's the thing. I mean, Brazilian sides have won the last 5 years. Now, yeah, it is interesting to look on 2019 as a turning point. But you look at the next 5 years, Ollie, and I mean, it's hard to make a case that a non-Brazilian side is going to win it. Of course, anything can happen as the Libertadores, but it really is quite hard to make a case. And another just a frame of reference, I think, for the dominance of Brazilian football, and Fluminense, who, of course, won it last year, beating Boca Juniors in the final, as Ollie Wilson spots away at Dengue Mosquito.
Another one.
Rage at the moment.
They love me. I do not like this. I seem to attract them. I get bitten through my T-shirts and stuff.
So I just want to talk a little bit about Fluminense and their performance on match day one, Ollie. Well, not really their performance, because they got a kind of 1-1, kind of job done. But their goalkeeper is basically 50 years old. Mm. Fabio. I mean, he's 43. Like that. Bear in mind that the champions on the continent, they've got Felipe Melo, who's 40, turns 41 this year. Then the other, I think the back five, everyone was over the age of 34 that they put out. I mean, is there any other competition in the world where you can get away with a 43-year-old goalkeeper and a 40-year-old centre-back? I mean, Ollie, that is, you know, he's genuinely pushing 50, Fabio. What would you, do you think that means anything? It was just random, those are the best players and they kept themselves in great nick. And we know all about Felipe Melo. I mean, guy's sort of a bit of a madman, bit of a cult figure down here in South America.
He's a walking yellow card.
Yeah, I mean, he's a walking, yeah.
Well, AC Milan used to do it. Italian football used to do it a lot. You know, you had players like Cafu kicking around until they were 40 plus.
And successfully.
Yeah, I mean, they got to Champions League finals with players that were pushing the later 30s, early 40s kind of margin. You know, Maldini was there forever, etc. That's the last time I think I can recall in Europe, though, that being the case. You have the odd player like, you know, Zlatan was playing long into, look at Giroud as well now. Not in the same level.
Individual,
but,
sure. Yeah. But I mean, sort of as a
collectively,
unit.
Yeah. No, you don't see that at all anymore. But that is also, that's the price that South American football is paying right now for its, the way it's fallen behind so many other leagues around the world, is that a 50-year-old, 40-year-old legend is better than the 25-year-old who wasn't good enough at a young age to go off to Europe. I mean, there are some players I think that obviously are an exception. You look at that Flamengo side that hasn't changed, as you touched on when we were talking earlier this week. There's still like De Arrascaeta's there, Bruno Henrique's there, and they were 4 years ago, 5 years ago in their pomp, you know, players that you thought, wow, I mean, how have they not done something in European football or tried a bit harder, or somebody hasn't seen what they want, because on this stage they looked head and shoulders above everybody else. But
Bruno Henrique is a good example, isn't he? Because Ozzoli, I mean, he's a bit older, but you know, we're a bit older as well. Because I remember when we first touched down the continent in 2019, early 2019, it was like, wow, Bruno Henrique's 26, 27. Does he still have time to? I know he went to Germany, didn't work out earlier in his career. Does he still have time to, you know, go and be picked up by a mid-table Serie A or La Liga club?
Worth a punt for a cheap bit of money.
I would have thought so. Yeah. Didn't happen, and now he's at the grand old age of 33, and, you know, grandfather time waits for no man.
But he's going to be one of those players that will be 37, 38 and still trying to run the show as a number 10 behind a centre-forward, probably Gabigol when he's finally back from his suspension. And you'll be looking at Bruno Henrique then and being like, yeah, that's the next old guy that's better than having a mediocre middle-aged, or middle-aged in terms of football, 25-year-old who hasn't gone across to European football and hasn't been picked up at that young age instead, because they're just worth having, these old guys at this level. Also the pace. I don't know if it's the grass and the turf they have on this continent, and I've been meaning to bring this up probably for about 4 years, but the pace of the game can be so lethargic because the ball doesn't seem to like skip off a surface or run as clean. And that maybe, look, we're used to immaculately manicured pitches in European football at the top level, but even compared to, you know, things like non-league football that I've covered, the ball feels so slow on some of them.
Also, conditions are crazier here. As in, Europe, I mean, yeah, it gets a bit cold, there's a bit of rain, but, you know, here you'll have, like, months, you know, torrential downpours, and, you know, the summer's super hot, and then, I don't want to go on and on about, I don't want to make it the Dengue podcast, but, you know, there's been so much rainfall.
We can't stop talking about it on this. I've noticed you've dropped it at least once, so,
you
know.
Argentines are hypochondriacs, and they're obsessed with it, so it's like, yeah, but... All right, Ollie. Well, I mean, this podcast was always going to be a bit of a sort of a briefer easing back into the pod world. What else from the Libertadores caught your eye? I mean, I don't know whether you saw the goal from Rivers Fonseca from 45 yards out. It's the best goal of the week, I would have thought.
It's probably going to be the goal of the tournament.
Oh, statement! I don't think it will be, mate.
You think?
I think you will see some bangers. And I think it's the kind of goal that is quite good, but actually, like, it's not that good because... it's just a punt.
It's a hit and hope. Yeah. That's the thing you can say as a negative towards it, is that he's seen a bouncing ball and he's been like a kid on a playground. Bouncing ball like that, sod it. I'll lash a boot at it and see what happens. But it's an unbelievably good strike that loops over the keeper perfectly, and it's easy on the eye to view. You can watch it over and over again. So, yeah, we've had that. I haven't really noticed any kind of major upsets, to be honest.
No, I mean, look, I think the macro upset is the Brazilian side not getting the results that people thought they would. But, you know, if you look at the odds, it's still very much heavily favoured in favour of the Brazilian side.
Well, like, think about Flamengo in 2019 when we saw them. They weren't that impressive. They almost went out to Emelec in the first knockout stage. And then, but we look at that tournament as in, based on what, 5 games going... that's one of the best teams on this continent that you'll see because of the quarterfinals and semifinals.
Yeah,
and then the
they're amazing in the semis. And
the Brazilian sides, I don't think any football team has an ability to just turn it on and off, much like the Ording. But I do think that they have the resources to be, right, just get through. Even if it's second in the group, it doesn't matter. Just get through and we're golden. So I think that'll be... something to watch as we go through this.
The veranda technology. It's a sun sensor on it. The sun comes on, if the sun comes through the clouds, it's trying to this afternoon in the heart of beautiful Buenos Aires.
Wouldn't you want it to be away when the sun is?
No, because the sun's coming through now, so it automatically, the veranda comes
across. But if the sun stays out and you put it back, it'll stay back. It won't be like, oh no, there's some sun here, I'm going to come back out again. Because I'd want to sit in the sunshine without that automatically coming over and being like, oh, I'll go in the shade.
Some people like a bit of shade.
It's the dengue protector, that's what it is. It's an extra...
it's got to be.
It's a giant mosquito net.
We'll do a pod after match day two as well, Ollie. But are you expecting match day two, the Brazilian side, to be like, okay, state championship wrapped up, now's the time that we get points on the board, especially at home?
I'll be interested to see. I mean, I've got Palmeiras next week as one of my games, so that'll be that's actually one of the highlights of the week, I think, getting to cover them, of course. with the run that they've had in this competition over the last few years. So we'll see about that. I mean, I've been heavily involved in the Sudamericana. I did six games of that rather than the Libertadores. So my attention's been slightly miscued over towards the sister competition, so to speak.
Which
sister.
Is in its own, it's a wonderful competition full of little, you know, narratives and upsets. And I know Wilson's always got his eye on the next big thing here, and he's hearing nuggets from the Peruvian press about this left back and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's the purest, the Sudamericana is the purest competition.
I was gutted I didn't get to see Montiel's younger brother playing this week. I think it's at Argentinos Juniors. Didn't come out, obviously, was where one of the McAllisters was as well. I think Kevin McAllister played at Argentinos Juniors for a bit, unlike Alexis. So, yeah, there are a few people that you do want to see, or some names that you kind of see and recognise. Paulo Guerrero is still leading the line. I mean, won the competition, the Sudamericana, last year with Liga de Quito, and has moved across to Delfin now our winter South American summer in January, and is now leading the line for them. It's like, really? No, it's not Delfin. Cesar Vallejo, sorry. Yeah, so, yeah, it's bonkers the names that continue to crop up. I'm expecting Rocky Santa Cruz to appear somewhere, even though I'm pretty sure, I'm almost 100% sure he has finally retired. But yeah, he'll come out of retirement, knockout stages, someone will need him, something like that.
Was it Adebayor that came down for... Was it Adebayor?
Manuel Adebayor. He was...
Didn't he play for... Let's see where Rocky Santa Cruz is before we wrap up the pod.
This is the special section that we've done every year of Santa Cruz Watch.
Rocky Santa...
Which Paraguayan side is he popping up
now? He must be... How old is he now? He's 42.
Oh, right. Okay. I thought he was 42 when we covered him last on the podcast.
Yeah, I get it. Must be one of those with the I mean, he hasn't played at all in 2024, so yeah, we'll see.
But, which club?
I think he's still at Libertad, no?
Bloody hell. But they got knocked out, didn't they? No, Olimpia got knocked out by a Paraguayan side. It was a big upset for the Sudamericana knockout stage. Quite a lot of debutants as well on the continental stage this year, I've noticed. Tomayapo, the Bolivian side. There's quite a few of them that have never been in the group stage or never been at this level of competition, which is a great story. It's a story that lasts like a line in commentary, and then maybe if they get a win or a goal, it's their first ever goal or their first ever win. And then it's like, oh, right, we just need to get down to actual business now. So it seems like a really fun story, and then you're like, well, that's 30 seconds of a 90-minute broadcast, and yeah, on we go. And it's probably an intro as well. So it's done after the team's walk, basically.
But it is great getting access to those kind of football clubs. It's super, super neat.
I wish fans had more access to those football clubs, because the stadium attendances for some of these games is upsetting.
But, you know, cost of living, man.
Well, definitely. Like... But that's where football has a problem. In that if you're not filling out stadiums at these sorts of tournament levels... For whatever reason it is, that's sad. Maybe it's obviously there are some of these clubs are used to playing in 7,000 seater stadiums, but because it's not equipped to hold a continental game, they have to move to the national stadium in Asuncion for whatever reason instead, which then it's difficult for the fans to get there, it costs money to get there, and then you've got to pay for a ticket. But I think there's got to be a way around that. I'd encourage CONMEBOL, I'm making a plea to CONMEBOL right now, can we allow some of these smaller stadiums to be used for these continental competitions? Look, if it means we can't have VAR, that might be a blessing in disguise. But if we can have that, I think that would be better for the competition. I'd rather see 3,000 people packed into a 7,000 person arena than have 3,000 people milling about in the background of a 60,000 seater stadium. Because you lose your home field advantage and the intensity of an atmosphere that should be there for this sort of competition.
All right, there we go. Did we, half an hour?
23 minutes.
Yeah, that's a nice number, I think, to get us back and underway. We'll do another one next week to we'll breach the half hour mark. But welcome back to anyone that's to the Law fans that tuned in 2019 and still here in 2024. Welcome back. We're still audio only. We'll all go video one day. But, one day.